However, as incredible as it seems, I have a book that the Hinderleys and the rest of the village has not read. And I thought that you, oh, I've got a friend. Is it worth, well, wait a minute, wait just a minute, I'll ask you in a minute. And so I mentioned this to somebody, and I was faced with the question, if they haven't read it, is it worth it? And that faced me just after lunch today. What would you say?
It's worth it.
Good, thanks. I've got a backer. And so in this book, and the reason that I wanted Ron to announce it as Mr. God, M-I-S-T-E-R, because this is Anna's name for Mr. God. It's not a title, M-R, capital M-R, period. Mr. God is her affectionate name for Mr. God. And so when I read it, think of this now as her familiar word to God. Whatever I'm going to say is going to be based on this book. So it's not a book review, though it'll turn out to be that, I'm sure. But I want it to be more than that. And my hope is that I won't violate the real intent of the book in picking out bits and pieces to relate to you a subject sort of within the book. Because after all, this is her attitude toward God. And so in the reading, and her whole approach to life, and in the reading of it, of what I do, these fragments, I thought to pick out the parts that will tell you what she thinks of God. And in picking these parts out, that it will also ask you a few questions and maybe also contribute to your attitude toward God. It kind of hits me because I have loved fairy tales. I like the world of imagination. I like fantasy. And consequently, in this day and age, I'm so pleased that we can read without any shame or covering up the fact that we enjoy the Hobbits of Tolkien and the Narnia series, for instance, and others of Lewis, and the curdy stories of MacDonald that are a little harder to come by, but are in the same vein and are just wonderful. And all of those is only an example of some of the reading that becomes available to us. You talk about, I hear so frequently, you know, and the fellows at the seminary kind of kicked against the, why do we have to take Hebrew? I don't know, I don't think they do anymore. Why do we have to take Greek? Maybe they don't have to take that anymore either, I'm not quite sure. But why do we have to take these subjects? We're getting back a little now. There was a time, you know, you didn't, to sit in class was a waste of time. You had to be out doing. And then we'd have some poor professors struggling with trying to teach the concept that you need tools. If you're going to be of value in any field, you needed certain tools make you suited for whatever it was you wanted to do. Well, and I can't quite imagine how can anyone move into the world of academic thought in philosophy or religion or any of these areas without having been exposed and exercise the world of imagination. It seems to me this could be as much a tool, if you want to call it that, as anything. And you have to live in the world of pretend and fantasy at the age of 6, it seems to me, in order to accomplish this. Which reminds me of, you know, you look at your children or you look at the children you teach or into your own childhood and remember some incidents. And one of our sons, at about that age, was, I think, just thinking up one good new trick to avoid going to bed yet. And so when the stories were read and it was time for everybody to be tucked in, he shook his head and held me back. Oh, we couldn't go out in the back hall to get up the stairway. Why not? There's a lion out there. And I, well, what in the world were we going to do about that? How are we going to get upstairs? How are we going to get rid of the lion? Oh, I think he'll go away pretty soon. I think he'll let me put him to bed pretty soon. About how long? Oh, just about long enough for another story. And so we had another story. And sure enough, at the end of the story, Peter went out first. I better let him go first. And he took the lion by the neck and marched him down the basement stairway and shut the door, and now we could go to bed. Well, this was sort of normal in our household. Nobody was very surprised or think anything of it. But I had told the story, and just a few days later, the social worker came by our house and wanted to know if we wanted her to take Peter from her house. Well, I couldn't imagine what in the world she was talking about. To find out that she had just had the sad, I was going to say duty, sad happening. She had to go out to a wonderful foster home, really. They were very nice people. And she had to go out there because this little child, living in out in a farm home where there were no other little children, had an imaginary playmate all day. And finally, the foster mother had it. She said, "I just can't have him here. He lies." And Ida had to take that child from the home. And this was following it. That's why she wanted to know if she should take Peter, too, because he lied. But that was the concept. And I'm afraid that there are some of these people who don't know this world of imagination. And if you don't, you're not going to be with us very long right now, because in our expressing ourselves and in this world, and this is not imagination, well, maybe it is, that one of the greatest possibilities that we have is in the world of faith. And I think it takes imagination, and it, because you can't grasp faith, you just have to have faith. And it's growing in you all the time. We have faith in lots of things, but what I want to talk about is our faith in God. And I would like to talk about it in the context of this book, because it expresses one little girl's faith and her, quote, working on a man that we will call Finn, F-Y-N-N, because that's what she called him. And here she will give a reflection of what is the purpose of being, and how do you live love. And instead of my telling you how this came to be, I'd like to read the introduction that was presented by William Collins, who is the chairman of the Collins Publishers in London. "The story of Anna is so strange and so enchanting that at first I found it difficult to believe it was about real people. Anne was a little girl of 4 when Finn, a young man of 19, found her late at night sitting outside a baker's shop in London's Dockland. She had run away from her parents, who had been ill-treating her. Her bruised body told the story. She was determined not to return to them and refused to say where she lived. Finn took her home, where his large-hearted mother took her into the family circle as one of her own. An unusual and moving friendship developed between the little boy and the big young man. He found her to be not only a delightful and interesting child, but a kind of infant prodigy, especially in God thinking. She wrestled with profound theological issues in her own intuitive and reasonable way, and expressed her findings in startlingly simple words. As Finn writes, Anna was not only deeply in love with Mr. God, she was proud of him. The fact that she spoke the rough language of the street made her pronouncement all the more astonishing, sometimes breathtaking. A bomb with legs on is how Finn described Anna. Indeed, she seems such an unusual child that sometimes the reader may wonder, as I did when first confronted with the author's manuscript, whether she is not in fact a fictional character, a kind of mini-myth invented by an adult of original and questing mind as the means of communicating thoughts about God in a new language. But I am convinced that Anna was a real little girl who, in fact, was found in the streets at the age of 4 and who died as a result of an ugly fall at the age of 7. The manuscript, just 60 pages of it, was brought into my office by a man who told us that the author was a friend of his and that it was most unlikely he would be willing to meet me. Those first 60 pages were enough for me to realize that the story of Anna was not of the most exceptional, that was one of the most exceptional manuscripts that I ever had had the chance of publishing. The problems that faced me were, who is the author and is this a story about real people? And how could I find out if the author refused to come to see me? At last, after long negotiations, he agreed to come. Finn arrived in a very bellicose mood. The reason he was reluctant to meet us was that Anna's death, that had been for him such a traumatic experience about 30 years, had had to pass before he felt he could write about her. Anna was still so much a part of his life that he dreaded to expose her to what he thought would be the arrogant, rough and tumble of a commercial publisher's editorial and publicity expertise. After Anna's death, Finn had suffered a nervous breakdown. He is now a brilliant scientist and computer expert. Meeting him was a dramatic experience. Here in front of us was undoubtedly the Finn one had met in the book. Tall, handsome, sensitive, with an innocence and honesty that is rare to meet. In a matter of seconds, I found that I was on the same wavelength and just sat back and listened to Finn telling the story of Anna. I sent a brilliant editor to stay with Finn and his wife in the country to discuss the many editorial problems that arose during the writing of the book. There was so much material to use, cutting was necessary so that Anna's character should not be hidden under a load of details. Our editor loved his visits to Finn. They talked far into the night. Our editor himself had worked in the East End some 30 years ago, and he knew so well the scenes and atmosphere described by Finn. We were determined from the very start that Finn should remain anonymous. He felt, and we agreed, that if he'd had to relive the story of Anna over and over again in interviews, it would be very upsetting for him. I have been asked, is the book genuine? My reply is that I won't claim every word is verbatim, but the substance, mood, and atmosphere is authentic. In all my publishing experience over 50 years, I have never handled such an amazing story. Now that's his evaluation. From now on, I will read the words of either of the story. And it starts, the difference, D-I-F-F-R-E-N-S-E. The difference from a person and an angel is easy. Most of an angel is in the inside, and most of a person is on the outside. These are the words of six-year-old Anna. At 5 years, Anna knew absolutely the purpose of being, knew the meaning of love, and was a personal friend and helper of Mr. God. At 6, Anna was a theologian, mathematician, philosopher, poet, and a gardener. If you asked her a question, you would always get an answer in due course. On some occasions, the answer would be delayed for weeks or months, but eventually, in her own time, the answer would come, direct, simple, and much to the point. For I knew her on her own terms, the way she demanded to be known, from the inside first. Most of an angel is in the inside, and this is the way I learned to know her, my first angel. And then he describes himself a little. My great delight was to roam about Dockland in the nighttime, particularly if it was foggy. Now this is in London, East End of London. My life with Anna began on such a night. I was 19 at the time, prowling the streets and alleys with my usual supply of hot dogs, the streetlights with their foggy halos showing dark, formless shapes moving out from the darkness of the fog and disappearing again. And then he describes the baker's shop and saw a little girl sitting in front of one. In those days, children wandering the streets at night were no uncommon sights. I had seen such things before. But on this occasion, it was different. How or why it was different has long since been forgotten, except that I'm sure it was different. I sat down beside her on the grating, my back against the shop front. We stayed there about 3 hours. And looking back over those hours, I can now cope. Looking back over 30 years, I can now cope with those 3 hours. But at the time, I was on the verge of being destroyed. And then he goes on, and she finally takes some of them. Hot dog. I have to skip because there's so much I'd like to read that I'm hoping I can get around. I took out a woodbine and lit up and offered her the match to blow out. She blew, and I was sprayed with bits of hot dog. This little accident produced such a reaction in her that I felt that I had been stabbed in the guts. I had seen a dog cringe before, but not a child. The look she gave me filled me with horror. She expected a thrashing. She clenched her teeth as she waited for me to strike her. What my face registered, I don't know. Perhaps anger and violence, or shock and confusion. Whatever it was, it produced from her the most piteous whimper. I can't describe this sound after all these years. No words are fitting. The feeling I can still taste and experience, and which gives you a little bit of an idea of her. And I'm not going to, there's so much that's so beautiful. I hope you will read it someday, because and there's so many parts I had to just sort of turn the page and hope. Now, here's what he called her. "What's your name, Titch?" I asked her. "Anna, what's yours?" "Finn." "Where do you come from?" I didn't get an answer to this question. And that was the first and last time I didn't get an answer to a question. I gathered later the reason for this. It was because she was afraid that I might have taken her back. "When did you run away?" "Oh, 3 days ago, I think." But he called her Titch, not knowing her name, and that name stuck for her. And you will find that as we go on. Then they find their way home, finally, instead of the usual, "Okay, Mom, won't be long," when he came home, she would, even though she had gone to bed, would always call to him. But this night, I opened the door and yelled down the passage, "Mom, come and see what I've got." One thing about Mom, she was never fussed about anything. She took everything in her stride. Bossy, the cat I brought home one night, and Patch, the dog, 18-year-old Carol, who stayed with us for 2 years, and Danny from Canada, who stayed about 3 years. Some people collect stamps or beer mats. Mum collected waifs and strays, cats, dogs, frogs, people, and as she believed, a whole host of little people. Had she been confronted with that night with a lion, she'd have made the same comment. The poor thing. One look when she came through the door was enough. "The poor thing," she cried. "What have they done to you?" And then as an afterthought to me, "You look a right mess. Wash your face." With that, Mum flopped onto her knees and put her arms around Anna. And then, of course, she needed a bath, and that was going to be the first procedure, and I'll only read a little bit about the comments that Stan, the fellow, or Carol, the girl, made. That poor little body was bruised and sore. The four older people in the kitchen were ready to bash someone, and for a time we were lost in our own anger. But Anna sat and grinned, a huge, face-splitting grin. Like some beautiful sprite, she sat there, and I believe for the first time in her life, she was entirely and completely happy. Then they get ready to go to bed. "Ain't you going to say your prayers?" she asked. So somewhere along the line, she must have had some sort of a home and bringing up. "Well, yes," I replied, "when I get to bed." "I want to say mine now," she said. So we both got down on our knees. She talked while I listened. I've been to church many times and heard many prayers, but none like this. I can't remember much about her prayer, except that it started off with, "Dear Mr. God," this is Anna talking. And she went on in such a familiar way of talking to Mr. God that I had the creepy feeling that if I dared look behind me, he'd be standing there. I remember her saying, "Thank you for letting Finn love me." And I remember being kissed goodnight, but how I got to bed, I don't know. Mum and Anna shared many likes and dislikes. Perhaps the simplest and most beautiful sharing was their attitude toward Mr. God. Most people I knew used God as an excuse for their failure. He should have done that, or why has God done this to me? But with Mum and Anna, difficulties and adversities were merely occasions for doing something. Ugliness was the chance to make beautiful. Sadness was the chance to make glad. Mr. God was always available to them. A stranger would have been excused for believing that Mr. God lived with us. But then Mum and Anna believed he did. Very rarely did any conversation exclude Mr. God in some way or other. After the evening meal was finished and all the bits and pieces put away, Anna and I would settle down to some activity, generally of her choosing. Fairy stories were dismissed as mere pretend things. Living was real and living was interesting and, by and large, fun. Reading the Bible wasn't a great success. She tended to regard it as a primer strictly for the infants. The message of the Bible was simple, and any halfwit could grasp it in 30 minutes flat. Religion was for doing things, not for reading about doing things. Once you had got the message, there wasn't much point in going over and over the same old ground. Our local parson was taken aback when he asked her about God. That conversation went as follows. Do you believe in God? Yes. Do you know what God is? Yes. What is God then? He's God. Do you go to church? No. Why not? Because I know it all. What do you know? I know to love Mr. God and to love people and cats and dogs and spiders and flowers and trees, and the catalog went on, with all of me. Oh, I'd like to read about one of her favorite readings was the Prudence Complete Concordance. And another one was, her first love was a large picture book with nothing in it but photographs of snowflakes and frost patterns. The concordance was next, and the third was Manning's Geometry of Four Dimensions. Now we're back looking at a four-year-old. That first introduction was just telling a couple of things when she was six and when she was five. Now she's four. And then she would read something and then be quiet about it. And then Finn knew that he just had to wait. And then after a while, a long time after, and he wouldn't know what she was talking about because he wouldn't know to which of the things she was going back, because now she had found her answer. And she had boxes that she kept many things in. And I hope this won't kind of be in the middle of something. Since our first meeting, God had been given the title Mr. God. The Holy Spirit, for some reason only known to her, was given the name of Varak. I never heard her use the name Jesus. One evening she referred to Jesus. Whenever she referred to Jesus, it was as Mr. God's boy. You know, it just hurts to skip some of this. Mr. God made everything, didn't he? There was no point in saying that I didn't really know. I said yes. Even the dirt and the stars and the animals and the people and the trees and everything and the polywog. The polywogs were those little creatures that we had seen under the microscope. Yes, he made everything. Does Mr. God love us truly? Sure thing. Mr. God loves everything. Oh, well then, why does he let things get hurt and dead? Her voice sounded as if she felt she had betrayed a sacred trust, but the question had been thought, and it had to be spoken. I don't know. There are a great many things about Mr. God that we don't know about. Well then, if we don't know many things about Mr. God, how do we know he loves us? I could see that this was going to be one of those times, but thank goodness she didn't expect an answer to her question, for she hurried on. Them polywogs, I could love them till I bust, but they wouldn't know, would they? I'm million times bigger than they are, and Mr. God is million times bigger than me, so how do I know what Mr. God does? She was silent for a little while. Later, I thought that at this moment she was taking her last look at babyhood, and then she went on, Finn, Mr. God doesn't love us. He doesn't really, you know. Only people can love. I love Bossy, the cat, you remember. But Bossy don't love me. I love the Pollywogs, but they don't love me. I love you, Finn, and you love me, don't you? I tightened my arm about her. You love me because you are people. I love Mr. God, truly, but he doesn't love me. It sounded to me like a death knell. I thought, why does this have to happen to people? Now she's lost everything. But I was wrong. She had got both feet firmly planted on the next stepping stone. No, he don't love me. Not like you do. It's different. It's billions of times bigger. I must have made some movement or noise, for she leveled herself upright and sat on her haunches and giggled. And then she launched herself at me and undid my little pang of hurt, cut out the useless spark of jealousy with the delicate sureness of a surgeon. Finn, you can love better than any people that ever was, and so can't I. So can I, can't I? But Mr. God is different. You see, Finn, people can only love outside and can only kiss outside. But Mr. God can love you right inside. And Mr. God can kiss you right inside, so it's different. Mr. God ain't like us. We are a little bit like Mr. God, but not much yet. What was this child up to? What had she done? In the first place, God could finish things off. I couldn't. I'll accept that, but what did it mean? It seemed to me that she had taken the whole idea of God outside the limitation of time and placed him firmly in the realm of eternity. And then I wanted to read about her idea of four dimensions of point of view and points of view, but that's several pages, and I'm going to skip that. It was sometime during the end of this first summer, she's four, that she made two most startling discoveries. The first was seeds, that things grew from seeds, that all this beauty, these flowers, these trees, this lovely grass came from seeds. And moreover, you could actually hold these seeds in your hands. The second major discovery was writing. And I thought these two things were a little appropriate. I'm going to read another one a little later. But this is so appropriate here. The first time she held flower seeds in her hand was such a time. There was no need for words. Her actions and thoughts spoke for themselves. There she was in front of some wild flowers, kneeling down with a sprinkling of seeds in her hands. Her eyes located her thoughts. She looked at the seeds and her brow furrowed. She looked over her shoulder into the distance and her eyes popped in amazement. Back to the seeds, back over her shoulder. Finally she stood up, looked outward, where to I do not know, and slowly turned a full circle. By the time she faced me, her inner lamps had been turned full on. I didn't have to be told what was going on in her head. It was plain to see. The sharp needle of her thoughts had sewn together this flower-filled scene that we now occupied with the bare patches of land in the East End. Of course seeds could be transported from one place to another, so why not do it? She looked at me with large question marks in her eyes, and without a word, I gave her my clean pocket handkerchief. She spread this on the ground and with infinite care shook the seed pods. The white handkerchief was soon covered with the dark grains of the seeds. This activity of collecting seeds was one that I saw thousands of times. Never once was she violent with any seed pod, and on each and every occasion came the moment of decision. Have I taken too many? Are there enough left? Sometimes a decision could only be made after a careful inspection of the seed pods. If she decided she had taken too many, she would then proceed to portion out those seeds she had collected, sprinkling very carefully some portion back on the land again. Mr. God went up about 10 points in her estimation with regard to these seeds, as she said, "Ain't Mr. God wonderful?" Not only was Anna deeply in love with Mr. God, she was proud of him. Anna's pride in Mr. God grew and grew to such dimensions that in some idiot moment I wondered if Mr. God ever went pink with pleasure. Whatever feelings people have had about Mr. God over the many centuries, I'm very sure of one thing. Nobody has ever loved Mr. God more than Anna. On that evening in the street in East London, I stood with a child in my arms and looked into that lonely cell of humanity. No book learning, no lecture has shown me more than those few moments. Lonely the cell may be, but dark never. It wasn't dark behind those tear-filled eyes, but a blaze of light. And God made man in his own image, not in shape, not in intelligence, not in eyes or ears, not in hands or feet, but in this total inwardness. In here was the image of God. It isn't the devil in humanity that makes man a lonely creature. It's his God-likeness. It's the fullness of the good that can't get out or can't find its proper other place that makes for loneliness. Mr. God didn't mind at all making himself small. Now you see, this is one of the places, I don't know if that makes anything, maybe the rest will. People thought Mr. God was very big, and that's where they made a big mistake. Obviously, Mr. God could be any size he wanted to be. If he couldn't be little, these are the words of Anna, how could he know what it's like to be a ladybird? Indeed, how could he? So like Alice in Wonderland, Anna ate the cake of imagination and altered her size to fit the occasion. After all, Mr. God did not have only one point of view, but an infinity of viewing points, and the whole purpose of living was to be like Mr. God. So far as Anna was concerned, being good, being generous, being kind, praying, and all that kind of stuff had very little to do with Mr. God. They were, in the jargon of today, merely spin-offs. This sort of thing was just playing it safe, and Anna was going to have none of it. No. Religion was all about being like Mr. God, and it was here that things could get a little tough. The instructions were to be good and kind and loving, and it therefore followed that you would be more like God. No. The whole point of being alive was to be like Mr. God, and then you couldn't help but be good and kind and loving, could you? If you get like Mr. God, you don't know you are, do you? Are what? Good and kind and loving. This last comment was delivered in her throwaway tone of voice, as if it were insignificant and irrelevant. I knew this one of old. Either you had to pretend it hadn't happened or start asking questions. A moment or two of hesitation on my part as I watched the grin spin from her toes and explode in one short, sharp hoot of mirth, and I realized that she had sprung the trap. She had something to say and had forced me into asking the question. If I hadn't done it, then I would have had to sooner or later. So, okay, Titch, what's all this goodness and kindness and loving lark then? Well, and the tone of her voice slid down the roller coaster of excitement, shot up the other side and took off. Well, if you think you are, you aren't. From my position at the bottom of this particular class, I asked, how come? I thought I'd got the drift of the conversation and reckoned I was waiting for her about two steps ahead. She had signaled a right turn and I was waiting for her, but suddenly she took a left-handed U-turn and sped back against the oncoming arguments. Thrown off balance by this sudden switch, I could do no more than walk back to where she was waiting. Right, give. You don't expect Mr. God knows he is good and kind and lovingly, do you? I don't suppose I'd ever given this a moment's thought, but put like that, there was only one answer to give, even though I wasn't convinced of the truth of it. I guess not. The question why got stuck somewhere between my brain box and my vocal cords. I should have known that the whole of this conversation was leading to some conclusion, some idea, some statement that satisfied her completely. She gathered herself, holding her excitement in check. Suddenly, with an explosive gasp, she said, Mr. God don't know he's good and kind and loving. Mr. God is empty. Now, I accept that the stone that bruises my toe isn't really there. I don't mind entertaining the idea that everything is an illusion, but that Mr. God is empty simply goes against the grain. It stands to reason that Mr. God is full of knowing, full of love, full of compassion, you name it. He's full of it. Why God is like some gigantic Christmas stocking, full of good presents, inexhaustible, showering untold and unnumbered presents upon his children. Of course he's full. That's what I was taught, and that's how it was. Or was it? I got no more from Anna that day or for several days after. I stewed in my own juice. The idea that Mr. God was empty milled around my brain. Of course it was ridiculous, but it just stuck there. As a picture formed in my mind, I got more and more embarrassed and more ashamed. I hadn't seen this picture with such clarity before, but there he was, Mr. God, all dressed up in a dress suit, top hat and a wand, producing rabbits out of a hat. You put up your hand and asked for a motor car, 1,000 pounds, or what you will, and God met. Mr. God waved his magic wand, and out it all came. In the end, I saw my picture of Mr. God, a kindly, benevolent, and bewhiskered magician. A few days later, after a lot of wondering, came this how come this idea that Mr. God was quite empty, I asked the question that had puzzled me for days. Titch, what's with this Mr. God being empty stuff? She turned to me eagerly. I distinctly got the impression that she'd waited for this question for days, but couldn't do anything until I was ready for it. When the world went all red, they had prisms. When the world went all red through the bit of glass and the color from the flower, she answered. I remember that all right. We'd talked about transmitted light and reflected light. That light took on the color of the glass through which it was transmitted. That the color of the yellow flower was due to reflected light. We had seen the colors of the spectrum, and with the aid of a prism, we had looked at Newton's colored spinning disk and had mixed all the colors of the spectrum back to white again. I had explained that the yellow flower absorbed all the colors of the spectrum, with the exception of yellow, which was reflected back to the viewer. Anna had digested this bit of information for a while and then said, "Oh, yellow is the bit it don't want." And after a little pause, "So its real color is all the bits it do want." I couldn't argue with this, since I couldn't be sure what the heck a flower would want anyway. All these bits of information had been taken in, like the various bits of colored glass, shaken well and worked into her particular framework. It seemed that each and every individual was issued at birth with various bits of glass labeled good, bad, nasty, and so forth. People got into the habit of slipping these bits of glass over their inward eye and seeing things according to the color and label of the glass. This we did, I was given to understand, in order to justify our inner conviction. Now, Mr. God was a bit different from a flower. A flower that didn't want the yellow light was called yellow by us because that is what we saw. We couldn't say the same thing about God. Mr. God wanted everything, so he didn't reflect anything back. Now, if Mr. God didn't reflect anything back, we couldn't possibly see him, could we? So as far as we are concerned, so far as we are able to understand what Mr. God was, we simply had to admit that Mr. God was quite empty. Not empty because there was truly nothing there, but empty because he accepted everything because he wanted anything and didn't want to reflect anything back. Of course, if you could cheat if you wanted to, you could wear your bit of colored glass marked Mr. God is loving or the bit marked Mr. God is kind, but then, of course, you would miss the whole nature of Mr. God. Just imagine what kind of an object Mr. God must be if he accepts everything, if he reflects absolutely nothing back. This, said Anna, is being the real God. This is what we're being asked to do. Throw away our bits and pieces of colored glass and see clearly. The fact that old Nick was busy turning them out by the million made things a bit difficult at times, but that's the way things were. Sometimes grown-up kids have bits of glass. The price of not being frightened is trust. And what a word that is. Define it how you like, and I'll bet you miss the main point. It's more than confidence, more than security. It doesn't belong to ignorance, or for that matter, to knowledge either. It is simply the ability to move out of this I'm the center of all things and to let something or someone take over. And as for Anna, she had simply moved out and let Mr. God move in. So far as Anna was concerned, one thing was absolutely certain. Mr. God had made everything. There was nothing that God hadn't made. When you began to see what it was all about, how things worked, how things were put together, then you were beginning to understand what Mr. God was. The function of Mr. God is to make you like him. Then you can't measure, can you? As Anna said, if you are, you don't know, do you? You don't think Mr. God knows he's good, do you? Anne's opinion of Mr. God was that he was a perfect gentleman, and no gentleman would possibly swank about being good. If he did, he wouldn't be a gentleman, would he? And that would lead to a contradiction. It stands to reason, doesn't it? I know that daylight brings questions with it, that it's easy to accept these things at night in bed with a miniature angel by your side, but stay with it. The function of Mr. God is to make you like him. The various religions merely measure the properties, or some of them, for you. It doesn't really matter what color you are, what creed you subscribe to. Mr. God shows no preference in his function. We chatted about this and that. Miss Haynes, her teacher. What's wrong with Miss Haynes? Do Lily tap. She's barmy. Can't be. She's a school ma'am. You can't be a school ma'am if you're a doodally. She is. What makes you think? She said, I can't know everything. Guess she's right. Why? Suppose your noodle's not big enough. That's the outside. Oh, pardon me, I forgot. I can know everything inside. Ah. How many things are there? Squillions. More than numbers? No, more numbers than things. I know all the numbers, not the names. That's outside. Just the numbers. That's the inside. Yes, I guess so. How many squillions wave on that oscilloscope? Squillions. You know how to make squillions? Yes. That's inside. Suppose so. You seen them all? No. No, that's outside. Bless the child. I couldn't tell her that she had just framed the question that had for so long bothered me. Why can't I know everything? Because it's obvious that no man can know everything. So why try? Oh, I didn't mark that right, I guess. That's for if there's time. Feeding the ducks in the park the next day, I asked her how she got onto the idea of shadows. In the Bible, she announced. Where in the Bible? Mr. God said he would keep the Jews safe under his shadow. Oh, and then St. Peter. What about St. Peter? What did he do? Made people better. How'd he do that? He put his shadow on ill people. Oh, I should have remembered. And old Nick. How'd he get in? What's his name? Satan. Another one. The devil? No, another one. Finally, I hit on Lucifer. Yep. What's it mean? Light, I think. How about Jesus? Yeah, how about Jesus? What's he say? Lots of things, I suppose. What did he call himself? The Good Shepherd? Something else. The Way? Something else. Oh, you mean light. Yep. Old Nick and Jesus, both the light. You know what Jesus said, don't you? I am the light. What did he say it like that for? She had stressed the word I. So you won't get muddled. How do you get muddled? Two kinds of light, a pretend one and a real one, Lucifer and Mr. God. I suppose that the most frequently used words in Anna's writings and speaking were Mr. God. With regards to language itself, Anna was convinced that it could by and large be divided into two parts, the question part of the language and the answer part of the language. Of the two, the question part of the language was the most important. The answer part had a certain satisfaction, but was nowhere near as important as the question part. Questions were a sort of inner itch, an urge to go forward. Questions, that is, real questions, had this about them. They were risky things to play about with, but they were exciting. You never quite knew where you were going to land. Anna was certain that heaven was, certain that angels and cherubs and things like that were real, and she knew more or less what they were like. At least she knew what they were not like. For one thing, they weren't like those pictures of angels with nice feathery wings. It wasn't the wings that bothered her one bit. It was the fact that they looked like people that bothered Anna. The possibility that an angel could, let alone would want to, blow a trumpet, filled her with the deepest dismay. The idea that come the resurrection day, Anna would still have the same number of legs, still have eyes and ears, still be generally constructed after the same present pattern, was to her an idea too monstrous to contemplate. Why was it that grown-ups insisted on talking about where heaven was? The whole question of where heaven was neither here nor there. It was immaterial. It was nonsense. And why, oh why, were angels and cherubs and things like that, and goodness me, even God, Mr. God himself, represented as human people? Oh no, the question of where heaven was one of those non-questions. It had nowhere to land, and therefore was no question fit to be asked. As Anna saw it, the question of heaven was not concerned with where, but it was concerned with the perfection of the senses. Language was hard put to it when trying to describe or explain the concept of heaven. But then, language depended upon the senses, and it therefore followed that the grasp of heaven was also dependent upon the senses. These pictures, these statues, these stories about angels simply shouted aloud the fact that the perpetrators of these monstrosities had no idea what they were on about. They merely showed quite clearly that angels and such like were simply men and women with wings on. They were burdened with the same kind of senses as we were, and as such were not fit creatures for heaven. No, whatever the description of heaven was, and that was really most important, it didn't describe a place about the inhabitants. Any place could be heaven where the senses were perfect. Mr. God's senses were perfect. Well, it stands to reason to be able to see us over impossibly immense distances, to hear us and to know our thoughts were not unreasonable characteristics of Mr. God, or for that matter, the angels either. But to represent them in stories, paintings, or sculptures with ordinary ears, ordinary eyes, and ordinary shapes was childish in the extreme. If the heavenly hosts had to be painted, then they ought to be represented in such a way as to show the perfection of their senses, and since language depended upon the senses, the perfection of their language, too. And then it tells about her offense at Reverend Castle, using the seeing and knowing in such a clumsy way was a very sore point with Anna. The Reverend Castle talked about seeing Mr. God, about meeting him face to face in a sermon one Sunday morning. He never knew how close he was to disaster. And then she, in explaining this to Finn, said that Mr. God ain't got no face. What'll he do if he ain't got no eyes? Maybe this won't make sense. What then, Finn? This was right in church. She whispered to Finn, right then and there, because she turned to him and said, what's he going to do if Mr. God ain't got no face? What'll he do if he ain't got no eyes? What then, Finn? And the Reverend Castle faltered for a second and pressed on, dragging with him the heads and eyes of the congregation. So Anna mouthed the words, what then? Search me, I whispered back. She pulled on my arm and signaled me to come closer, her lips plugged into my ear. Mr. God ain't got no face. I turned my face to her and my raised eyebrows asked the question, how come? Because he don't have to turn around to see everybody, that's why. She settled back in her pew, nodding her head at her own certainty, and folded her arms with a full stop. On our way home from church, I asked her what she had meant by you don't have to turn around. Well, I've got an in front. I've got a behind. So I have to turn around to see what's behind me. Mr. God don't. What's he do then? Mr. God's only got an in front. He ain't got no behind. On our homeward journey, Anna practiced her newly discovered game with me. In the same manner that she launched her spiritual being at Mr. God, so she launched her physical being at me. And then he tells about the game. She would stand some distance off, run toward me, and launch herself at me. The run toward me was deliberate and active. The moment after her launch, she was completely passive and limp. She made no effort to help me catch her, no effort toward her own safety. Being safe meant not doing these things at all. Being saved meant trusting in another. Being safe was easy. You simply accepted Mr. God as a Superman who hadn't shaved for about 6 months or so, that angels looked like men and women with wings on, that cherubs looked like fat little babies with wings that couldn't support a sparrow, let alone 25 pounds or more of chubby infant. No, being saved was for Anna only possible in that act of creative violence to the images of being safe. Every minute of every day Anna lived, she totally accepted her life, and in accepting life, accepted death. Death was a fairly frequent topic of conversation with Anna. Never morbid or anxious, simply something that would happen at some time or other, and it was better to have some grasp of it before it happened than to wait until the moment of death and then get panicky about it. For Anna, death was the gateway to possibilities. It was Mum who provided Anna with the solution to the problem of death. Like Anna, Mum had this lovely gift of asking questions that landed some hers. What was God's greatest creative act, she asked one Sunday afternoon. Although I don't go along with Genesis, I answered, when he created mankind. That was Finn now. I was wrong, according to Mum, so I had another shot. I was still wrong. I ran through the 6 days of creation and drew nothing but blank looks. Suddenly it happened. Anna slowly placed her hands on the table and pushed herself upright. The gap had been bridged. Anna's matching smile had to wait while astonishment shaped her face. She gasped. It was the seventh day. Of course it was. The seventh day. I looked from one another to the other and cleared my throat to capture their attention. I don't get it. God worked all his miracles in 6 days and then shut down for a bit of rest. What's so exciting about that? Anna got off her chair and came and sat on my lap. This I knew. This was her approach to the unseeing and unknowing infant, me. Why did Mr. God rest on the seventh day, she began. I suppose he was a bit flaked out after 6 days hard work. He didn't rest because he was tired, though. Oh, didn't he? It makes me tired just to think about it all. Of course he didn't. He wasn't tired, wasn't he? No, he made rest. Oh, he did that, did he? Yes, that's the biggest miracle, rest is. What do you think it was like before God started on the first day? A perishing big bundle, I guess. Yes, and you can rest. And you can't rest when everything is in a big muddle, can you? I suppose not, but then? Well, when he started to make all the things, it got a bit less muddly. Makes sense. When he was finished making all the things, Mr. God had undone all the muddle. Then you can rest. So that's why rest is the very, very biggest miracle of all. Don't you see? I think now she's five. The sun is nice, said Anna, but it lights things up so much that you can't see very far. I agreed that sometimes the sun was so dazzling that on occasions one was quite blinded. That wasn't what she meant. Your soul don't go very far in the daylight because it stops where you can see. That's supposed to make sense, I asked. The nighttime is better. It stretches your soul right out to the stars, and that, she pronounced, is a very long way. In the nighttime, you don't have to stop going out. It's like your ears. In the daytime, it's so noisy you can't hear. In the nighttime, you can. The nighttime stretches you. I'm going to throw this in for the benefit of our local poets. Do you like poet, he asked. poetry? He asked. She's now met Woody, who is one of the characters down on the waterfront. And he doesn't think she's quite old enough for this kind of life with this rough community. And he says, "You're a bit young for this, aren't you, little one?" She waited a little while, and she sort of measured him. And then he passed the test, so he got his answer. "I'm old enough to live, mister." And so she was accepted. And he asked her after a while, "Do you like poetry?" Anna nodded. Old Woody settled the glowing tobacco in his pipe with his thumb. "Do you know," he said, sucking away, "do you know what poetry is?" "Yes, it's sort of like sewing." "I see," old Woody nodded, "and what do you mean by sewing?" Anna juggled the words around in her mind. "Well, it's making something from different bits that is different from all the bits." And then I'd like to just throw this one in too. Old Woody was right. The daylight schooled the senses. The night time developed the wits, stretched the imagination, sharpened fantasy, hammered home the memory, and altered the whole scale of values. I began to realize why most people went to sleep in the nighttime. It was easier, a whole lot easier. "Finn, I love you." When Anna said that, every word was shattered by the fullness of meaning she packed into it. Her I was a totality. Whatever this I was for Anna was packed tight with being, like the light that didn't fray. Anna's I didn't fray either. It was pure and all of one piece. Her use of the word love was not sentimental or mushy. It was impelling and full of courage and encouragement. For Anna, love meant the recognition of perfectibility in another. Anna saw a person in every part. Anna saw a you. Now that's something to experience, to be seen as a you, clearly and definitely, with no parts hidden. Wonderful and frightening. I'd always understood that it was Mr. God who saw you so clearly and in your entirety. But then all Anna's efforts were directed to being like Mr. God. So perhaps the trick is catching if only you try hard enough. By and large, I thought I could understand Anna's attitude to Mr. God. But on one aspect, I got stuck completely. Perhaps it was hidden in, and here he quotes from the Bible, "Thou didst hide these things from the wise and understanding, and didst reveal them unto babes." How she managed it, I truly don't know. But in some manner, she had scaled the walls of God's majesty, his awe-inspiring nature, and was on the other side. Mr. God was a sweetie. Mr. God was fun. Mr. God was lovable. Mr. God was for Anna pretty straightforward, not presenting her with any real problem in the understanding of his nature. The fact that he could and often did put a large monkey wrench in the works was neither here nor there. He was perfectly free to do so, and obviously it was for some good purpose, even though we were not able to see or understand that purpose. Anna saw, recognized, admitted to, and submitted to all those attributes of God so often discussed. Mr. God was the author of all things, the creator of all things, omnipotent, omniscient, and at the very heart of all things, except. It was this exception that Anna saw as the key to the whole thing. This exception was funny, exciting, and made Mr. God the sweetie he was. What puzzled Anna was that nobody had seen it before. At least if they had seen it, nobody seemed willing to talk about it. It was very odd, since it was for Anna so strange a thing that only Mr. God could have thought about it. All the other qualities of Mr. God, those qualities so often talked about in church and school, were magnificent, tremendous, and let's face it, a little frightening. Then he had gone and done this thing. It made him lovable, funny, giggly. You could, if you wish, deny that Mr. God existed, but then any denial didn't alter the fact that Mr. God was. No, Mr. God was. He was the kingpin, the center, the very heart of things, And this is where it got funny. You see, we had to recognize that he was all these things, and that meant that we were at our own center, not God. God is our center, and yet it is we who acknowledge that he is the center. That makes us somehow internal to Mr. God. This is the curious nature of Mr. God, that even while he is at the center of all things, he waits outside us and knocks to come in. It is we who open the door. Mr. God don't break it down and come in. No, he knocks and waits. Now it takes a real super kind of God to work that one out, but that's just what he's done. And as Anna said, that's very funny, isn't it? It makes me very important, don't it? Fancy God, fancy Mr. God, taking second place. Anna never got involved in the problem of free will. I suppose she was too young, but she had got to the heart of the matter. Mr. God took second place. Ain't that something? Then one day, they did experiments frequently, and one day she wanted two paddle wheels. Couldn't imagine what for, but then she goes about making up her experiment. While I made the paddle wheels, Anna assembled her experiment. Oh dear, you know what? I don't think I have time. It was supper at 5:30? Mm-hmm. I guess I'll skip that one. No, I guess I won't.
They had quite a few experiments.
Yeah, they really did.
They were a wonderful man for her.
Yeah, and I've really skipped several of them that were kind of too bad. But this one, when she did it, she filled a large tub with water and had a hose, and then Finn was the paddle wheels, and then she asked him, "Do you like it, Finn?" "I like it, but what is it?" "That's you," she said, pointing to the tin with its paddle wheel. "Bound to be, but what am I doing?" "The water is Mr. God." "Gotcha." "The water comes out of the tap into the bath." "I'm still with you." "It goes into the tin." "That's you, through the hole, and makes you work like a heart." "Ah. When you work, it comes out of this tube, and that other makes, and that makes the other wheel work." "What about the drain?" "Well, if I had a little pump like Mr. God's heart, I could pump it all back into the bath. Then I wouldn't need the tap. It would just go round and round." So there you are then. How to make a model of Mr. God with a couple of paddle wheels. No, I just had something else, didn't I? Well, anyway, and I am going to skip, I have to. 2 days after the funeral, Anna's funeral, I found Anna's seed pouch. It gave me something to do. I went to the cemetery and stayed for a little while. It just made things worse, that much more empty. If only I had been nearer at the time of her accident. If only I had known what she was doing. If only. I tipped the seeds on the freshly turned earth and hurled the pouch from me in misery. I wanted to hate God, wanted him out of my system, but he wouldn't go. I found God more real, more strangely real than ever before. Hate wouldn't come, but I despised him. God was an idiot, a cretin, a moron. He could have saved Anna, but he didn't. He just let this most stupid of all things happen. This child, this beautiful child, had been cut off, and was not yet 8. I forgot to tell you that Woody had, here was this down and outer on the east end of London, a very disreputable, in our words, kind of a man, and he quoted Shakespeare to her, and out of the sonnets of Shakespeare, she had, and the love of the story and the storytelling, many times they would pretend that they were Peach Blossom and Oberon and Titania, and they'd play games about that. And then Woody, Finn was thinking back over these days, and he remembered Woody, who had quoted some words of Coleridge and Goethe, and some of these words came back to him and kind of gradually came into the world of balance for him. And after some time, I'm not sure how long, the next day I headed back to the cemetery. It took me a long time to find Anna's grave. It was tucked away at the back of the cemetery. I knew that it had no headstone, just a simple wooden cross with a name on it, Anna. I found it after about an hour. And he, I wanted to laugh, but you don't laugh in a cemetery, do you? Not only did I want to laugh, I had to laugh. Okay, Mr. God, I laughed, I'm convinced. Good old Mr. God, you might be a bit slow at times, but you certainly make it all right in the end. Anna's grave was a brilliant red carpet of poppies. Lupines stood guard in the background. A couple of trees whispered to each other while a family of little mice scurried backward and forward through the uncut grass. Anna was truly home. She didn't need a marker. You couldn't better this with a squillion tons of marble. I stayed for a little while and said goodbye to her for the first time in 5 years. But then I want to go back, and because I want to close with one example. I said that she had little boxes, and these boxes took care of certain things, and in one place, the only thing you can't put in a box is God. She'd been fascinated about the world of numbers, and they took on meaning to her like I hadn't thought of. And then she had taken numbers, and they had meant different things, and there was one good part that I was going to read, but I skipped. But like numbers, words also had a most important word, and this word, naturally enough, was God. Anna saw the most important one as the apex of a triangle. Number one, the triangle was standing, had to bear the weight of all the other numbers. Words were different. Words seemed to stand on piles of other words. These other words served the purpose of explaining the use and meaning the word and the meaning of the word on the top. The word God stood at the top of the pile that contained all the other words. And somehow or other, you were expected to climb to the top of this pile to understand the meaning of the word God. This was a daunting idea. The Bible, the church, the Sunday school were all busy building this colossal mountain of words, and it was doubtful if anyone could climb to the top of such a pile. Fortunately, good old Mr. God had, in his wisdom, already solved the problem for us. The solution of the problem didn't lie with words, but with numbers. The number one bore the weight of all the other numbers, so it must be wrong to expect words to bear the weight of the meaning of the word God. No, it must be that God is the word that bears the weight of all the other words. So the pyramid idea of words with God on the top is wrong side up. So turn it upside down. That's better. Now, the whole pyramid of words is standing on its apex, like the numbers. The apex of the word pyramid is God. And that must be right, because now the word God carries the weight and meaning of all the other words. Anna showed me her workings out. One sheet contained an upside-down triangle standing on the point labeled 1. This was the numbers triangle. One sheet showed a triangle standing on the point labeled God. And the last sheet in this shoebox showed a triangle standing on the point marked Anna. Ha! You've got a triangle all to yourself, I see. No, everybody has got one. Oh, what's it mean then? It's for when I die and Mr. God asks me all them questions. What about it? Well, I've got to answer them questions all by myself. Nobody can do it for me. I see, but what does the triangle mean? That I've got to be responsible, I suggested. Yeah, responsible. Yes, I see. You mean you've got to bear all the weight like those other triangles do. Yes, of all the things I've done and the things I've thought. Each word was underlined with a nod of satisfaction. She left me in the silence of her full stop. Took a little while for all this to sink in, but it was true. We've all got to bear the weight of our own actions. We've all got to be responsible, either now or later. We've got to answer Mr. God's questions all by ourselves. And when we think of Mr. God and of the magical child, Anna, maybe Anna can help us. And the things to remember about Anna, maybe through her, we can make them a part of our own selves. Because in this world of faith, each of us has to make our pattern for ourselves. Other people can help us. We can, through conversation, through reading, through listening, through contributing, we all build our own world of faith. But each of us must do it in our own way. And for each of us, there is a way. And maybe in our way, some of these things from Anna can help us. We are a little bit like Mr. God, but not much yet. Or it isn't the devil in humanity that makes man a lonely creature. It's his God-likeness. Move out and let Mr. God move in. Good old Mr. God, you might be a bit slow at times, but you certainly make it all right in the end. Mr. God takes second place. Ain't that something? Anna was turning over the pages. I think that was when I skipped. And then we've got to answer Mr. God's questions all by ourselves. Thank you.
Very, very good.
Thank you.
I hope you can all find Anna.